Welcome to this Bible study series entitled Heaven, Angels and All That. And welcome to those of you who are listening to this podcast and haven't been able to get to the Wednesday evening sessions, but also welcome to those who are perhaps listening to the podcast, even if you have been to the Wednesday evening sessions. We are, over the next 4 weeks, going to be looking at different aspects of this theme of what we mean by heaven. What is that place that we call heaven? Where do we go to when we die? What are our beliefs about life after death? And where do angels fit into all of this? This first talk is going to be done simply by me in terms of a summary of the input that I gave in the first session, because unfortunately that talk on the night didn't record properly. So you won't hear any contributions from people who were there, you'll simply just hear a talk from me. So here goes. What do we mean by heaven? Well, that's what we began the session with, a conversation around the tea and coffee tables, discussing what we mean and understand by heaven. I find that heaven is something that many people like to talk about, but don't, partly I think because there isn't a great deal that we can know about heaven with any kind of certainty, and therefore that makes us rather reluctant to pontificate on the subject. The Bible, on the other hand, really does have a great deal to say about heaven. So, what is heaven? Well, in truth, heaven is a great mystery, yet it's seen as an unseen reality governed by the things of God. Heaven suggests an answer to the familiar human feeling that there must be more to life than this, that there must be somewhere that we go to that makes sense of everything after we die. But of course, it's not just in religious contexts that we talk about heaven. It's not just talking about a place that we go to after death. Sometimes we talk about heaven as an experience of great joy, happiness, or contentment. My experience of doing funerals over the course of my ministry tells me that even amongst many non-churchgoers, there is still quite a strong belief in a place of an afterlife when we die. It's usually expressed in terms of the person who's died being at peace or being up there or reunited with members of the family or perhaps even experiencing something that they enjoyed on this earth for perpetuity in heaven. So, although people believe in a concept of heaven which is about a place we go to in an afterlife, people project onto that their own kind of interpretation of what heaven means to them. They fill it with the kind of meaning that they would like heaven to have. Perhaps that's why, in popular culture, heaven is really quite a strong concept. We can think of famous paintings depicting heaven, like Paradise by Hieronymus Bosch, or Jan van Eyck's painting Adoration of the Lamb. There was a film made way back in 1946 called A Matter of Life and Death, which explored the whole situation of going to heaven. There have been a number of novels written about heaven. Alice Sebold in 2002 wrote The Lovely Bones, and 2 years later Mitch Albom had published The Five People You Meet in Heaven. Even in the very popular series of the Harry Potter books, in Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, J.K. Rowling includes a scene in that book in which Harry Potter is seen with Professor Dumbledore in a white room. And there are many connotations of heaven in that particular scene. In music, of course, too, there have been many songs with references to heaven. Just to mention one or two, I'll Build a Stairway to Heaven, or Three Steps to Heaven. Going back further than that, we can think of Irving Berlin's song Cheek to Cheek, which begins with the words, I'm in heaven. Or the 1987 piece, Heaven is a Place on Earth, written by Rick Knowles and Ellen Shipley, and sung by Belinda Carlisle. And then there's Bob Dylan's Knocking on Heaven's Door and Eric Clapton's Tears in Heaven. But we also use heaven not just in terms, as I've said, of talking about the place we go to after we die, but also as a word that describes something that is blissful or delightful or fills us with great happiness and contentment. So we might talk, for example, about, oh, that chocolate cake was heavenly. We might even call it divine. And sometimes we describe holiday locations as being paradise. We read the brochures, don't we, where we find references to this paradise island. So we might conclude, just from a very brief overview of popular attitudes and culture, that for many people, heaven is the place where we go to when we die, but it's also used as a term to describe an experience of contentment and bliss. So if that's what people in general understand by heaven, what does the Bible understand by heaven? Well, it may or may not surprise you to know that the biblical view of heaven does differ to some extent from the popular view. Let me read you this quote from Paula Gooder in the introduction to her book, Heaven. She writes this: within the biblical tradition, the main portrayal of heaven is not the final resting place for human beings, or even as a place of contentment and bliss. Instead, heaven is seen as the dwelling place of God above the earth, where God is worshipped day and night by angels. The truth is that the majority of references to heaven in the Bible have nothing to do with where we go to when we die, but are actually concerned with the place where God dwells now, which is integrally related to the world as we know it. What we've ended up with in our culture is a kind of privatized and postponed conception of heaven. We've made it as something to do more with our own personal fate than to do with the presence and reality of God. So what we've done is we've pushed the reality of heaven off into an indefinite future and concluded that it has nothing to do with our life here on earth, so that there is, to some extent, a kind of a distance between heaven and earth, both a spatial or physical distance and also a spiritual distancing between earth and heaven in our thinking. One of the consequences of that is that we have, in many ways, devalued the created world, as the ultimate goal of our human existence has become the abandonment of our bodies and of this physical world for some kind of spiritual, disembodied, heavenly existence. But the biblical tradition primarily portrays heaven as not about us, but about God, and as something rather than affecting individuals in the future, is something that influences the whole world now. And what we've done is to disconnect that link, which the Bible affirms, between heaven and earth, and the way heaven is about what is happening now on the earth. So in order to try and get a handle on that biblical understanding of heaven as the dwelling place of God and of that connection between heaven and earth, we need to have a look at the way that the writers of the Bible understood heaven, the ideas and the concepts about heaven that they brought. In many languages around the world, the word for heaven and the word for sky are the same, which probably explains why, if we think about at all where heaven is, we tend to think that it's somewhere up there. It's part of our everyday language, isn't it? If there's a heavy downpour of rain, we say that the heavens opened. But the Bible doesn't actually distinguish in its use of language between the sky that we can look up and see and heaven as a dwelling place of God. It uses the same word for both. Why doesn't the Bible make that kind of distinction? Well, that's because of the worldview that the Bible was operating with. It's called Hebrew cosmology, which was the way the Jews understood the realities of heaven and earth, and the way in which that particular Jewish perspective influenced the later writers of the New Testament. Take, for example, the story of creation in Genesis chapter 1. It tells us there that God created the heavens and the earth. And when he created the earth, Genesis tells us, God made a distinction between the land, the earth, and the waters of chaos, which was all that there was before the Spirit hovered over the waters and brought out of them the earth. So what we get in Hebrew thinking is that above the earth there is a kind of dome or vault or firmament. The Hebrew word is translated in different ways, but we don't really have an exact English equivalent to it. This was like some kind of physical dome or vault, and it literally held back the waters of chaos which threatened to engulf the earth. So when we read in later chapters of Genesis about the flood and about Noah, what we are led to understand is that some kind of window in the heavens opened and the floodwaters poured down out from through that particular firmament and deluged the earth. Now, above that kind of dome or vault was the dwelling place of God, the place that we call heaven. And then at the opposite end, underneath the earth, there was a place called Sheol. And Sheol was a kind of shadowy underworld kind of place where people went to, where the Jews believed people went to after they died, but it wasn't the kind of place that you looked forward to going to. It wasn't a place of bliss or delight, such as people understand heaven to be. No, it was a kind of vague, nebulous, nothing kind of existence in that place. But it was just where people went when they died. Now, in Hebrew, the word that we translate as dome or vault or firmament is the word rakia, and it means an extended surface or expanse that is beaten out. This was the layer that separated heaven from earth, that kept the floodwaters at bay, and it was through the windows in the rakia, as I say, that the floodwaters came and deluged the earth. Now, the reason I say that heaven, which is where God is, and that's how the Bible understands heaven, the place where God is, the reason we know that that was above the firmament was from various references in the Old Testament that talk to us about God's dwelling place or God's throne. So, for example, in Exodus chapter 24, in the vision of God on Mount Sinai that Moses has, a description is made of a sapphire pavement, as though the rakia is both the floor of heaven and the ceiling or dome of earth. In the book of Ezekiel, it's said that God's chariot rests on the rakia. And in Job 22, verse 14, it speaks of God walking on the rakia, the dome or vault of heaven. So, in the biblical tradition, heaven can reflect both the place where God dwells, that is the place above the sky, above the firmament, and also, actually, it can translate the sky itself. But the other way in which the Bible uses the word heaven is that it's not only the dwelling place of God, but it's the dwelling place of angels as well. In Genesis chapter 28, we have the story of Jacob's ladder. And in that story, we hear about angels descending and ascending, coming down, going up on that ladder as Jacob sees it in his dream. A reference to that comes in John's Gospel, right at the end of chapter 1, in verse 51, where the writer says this: "And Jesus said to him, 'Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven opened, and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man.'" There are also the references, of course, in the Gospels to the ascension of Jesus. But of course, the problem for us living in the 21st century, as opposed to those living in the first century, is that we do not possess the same worldview as they did. Our worldview, or our view of the universe, does no longer fit in with a Hebrew understanding of the way the world is, and hence is at odds with the understanding that runs right through the Bible, because of extensive explorations of space, because of the use of telescopes and satellites and space stations and all of that. We know that there is not a physical dome, a rakia, above the earth. We know that heaven is not a place. We know that there isn't literally a physical throne of God somewhere there above the clouds, which may explain why we are rather reluctant when people want to talk about heaven, because if it isn't up there as people used to believe, then we don't really know where it is. And we can't really tell people with any kind of degree of certainty, well, that's where heaven is, and that's where you will go when you die. So do we, with our notion of an internalized spiritual heaven, pay enough attention to the biblical belief in the reality of heaven created and existing alongside the earth? Let me quote from Paula Gooder again. She says, The challenge facing us is to find language that fits our own worldview, but which also communicates with equal power our belief in a God who is transcendent, which means over and above all things, yet close to humanity, able to hear its voice and involved in the heaven and earth he so lovingly created. The fact that God not only created heaven and earth together, as Genesis 1 tells us, but that God also seeks to redeem both heaven and earth and make of them something new, is a truth that we find at the end of the Bible in Revelation chapter 21. So the Bible begins with this story about the creation of both heaven and earth. And in Revelation 21 and also chapter 22, we have this vision of God redeeming the heaven and earth he's created and making of them something new. The biblical view, right at the end of the Bible, is of a new heaven and a new earth. Jesus himself said, as we know from the Gospels, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. It's interesting to just notice how Revelation 21 begins with these words. John's vision is this: then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. So here we are presented with God doing something new, not just with the earth, but God doing something new with heaven as well. So that means that heaven, as we understand it now, is not an everlasting and permanent reality, but is something that is open to recreation. Only God, and not God's dwelling place, is everlasting and permanent. So eternity then is not about what is everlasting, that is going on and on and on and on forever without end, but what is outside time. 1,000 ages in thy sight are like an evening gone, as Psalm 90 tells us. The same may be true of the place where God dwells. And perhaps for our generation, Doctor Who can speak more to us about this theologically than many Christian commentators. So if God created heaven and earth together, as Genesis 1 tells us, and will recreate it, as Revelation 21 tells us, then it must be possible for God to live somewhere other than heaven. Going back to the book of Genesis, we see that in the beginning, it was not only God's intention, but it was the reality that God lived alongside human beings. He was there in the Garden of Eden with them. They knew of his presence, walking in the garden in the evening hour. And in Revelation 21, we find that vision of the heavenly Jerusalem coming down from heaven like a bride adorned for her husband, the new Jerusalem. And God saying, now he is going to dwell with mortals. In between the beginning of the Bible in Genesis 1 and the end of the Bible in Revelation 21, we've had a separation of God from man. And that's largely because of our own human sinfulness. Adam and Eve were thrown out of paradise, of the Garden of Eden, because they rebelled against God. They disobeyed him. They failed to do what God told them to do. Or rather, they did what he told them not to do, to eat of the tree that was in the middle of the garden. But it's always been God's intention to dwell with human beings. And that's the final vision that we have at the end of the Bible. And God sought to bring that about through sending Jesus. So Jesus is, if you like, the pivotal point, the one through whom God is able to approach us and through whom we are able to approach God. Jesus becomes, if you like, the new meeting place between heaven and earth, the new meeting place between God and humanity. So instead of thinking of heaven as somewhere far, far away, somewhere that is not only distant spatially, but spiritually, perhaps we need to start to think more about heaven and earth being actually very close together. I think John's Gospel describes this truth in many subtle ways. Let me take you back to that verse at the end of John chapter 1, where Jesus talked about the ladder, rather like Jacob's ladder, and about the Son of Man and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. The very next verse in chapter 2, at the beginning of chapter 2, introduces to us the first sign or miracle by which Jesus performed, by which his disciples came to believe in him. And it's the miracle of turning water into wine at the wedding feast at Cana in Galilee, which seems in many respects a strange miracle to be the first miracle that Jesus should perform. But I think the context of this miracle is very, very important, because John is at pains to tell us this at the beginning of chapter 2. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee. On the third day is a clear reference forward to the resurrection. Jesus rose on the first day of the week, but it was the third day after he had died and been buried in the tomb. John sees the whole act of resurrection as an act of new creation. And when a man and a woman come together in marriage, what is taking place is an act of new creation. As Jesus himself said in the Gospels, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. So they are no longer two, but one. I think John here uses the story of a wedding feast, of a marriage in Cana of Galilee, to give a kind of an insight into what he's going to be doing in his gospel, which is telling us that Jesus is that place where things that are opposite can be reconciled and can come together, where they can form a union, where they can be married to each other, if you like. John's gospel is full of contrasts like light and darkness, things like flesh and spirit, the world above and the world below. And what I think John portrays for us in his gospel is that all these opposites, which are spaced apart, between which there is so often a great distance, are brought together in Jesus. And it's in Jesus that the life of heaven and the life of earth come together. It's in Jesus, if you like, that there is a marriage between heaven and earth. So Paul Aguda says, the creation of heaven and earth reminds us that God's desire in creation was to dwell alongside humanity in a realm created for that purpose. Jesus comes to bring God and humanity together and to keep them together forever. So we might conclude then from what we have discovered in the biblical tradition that heaven and earth, far from being far apart from each other, both physically and spiritually, are actually very much closely bound together. That just as they were created together in the beginning. So God, at the end of time, when he establishes his kingdom in all its fullness, will redeem heaven and earth together. He will create a new heaven and a new earth. That is the emphasis of the biblical tradition in expressing its understanding about heaven, not simply as the place where we go to when we die. Because, of course, that understanding of an afterlife was a very much an emerging theology in the period of the Hebrew Scriptures, which we call the Old Testament. And we'll be looking a little bit more at that in next week's session. But let me, for now, leave you with a final quote from Paula Gooder's book on heaven. She says this: "Heaven cannot be seen simply as our destination after death. It is integrally related to our lives now. The events of earth are bound up with those of heaven. The two are intertwined and have been since the dawn of time."